Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 237 for April 11. Meet Chris Svensson of Ford Design. Watch Auto Line After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Well, Gary Vasilash, here we are again.
John, here we are in the studio. And before I forget, and while we have people here, next week we will not be in the studio. We'll be the New York show, and we'll have guests including Mark Fields, Chief Operating Officer of Ford. We'll have Dave Zuchkowski, the President and CEO of Hyundai Motor America. We'll have Mike Manley, President and CEO of Jeep, and a whole bunch of more people. So people definitely need to tune in for that one.
And I will not be there. And you're going to be holding down court at the New York show.
But if people have questions for those guys, they maybe send them in early, and we'll get those in hand. Just wanted to mention that now.
Let the audience know if they have questions for those executives.
Sure.
Shoot them in here, and Gary will ask those executives your question. And now we got to tell everybody here, we got Chris Pockert from Autoblog with us tonight as well.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here again.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, it sounds like a great list of people you've got going. I'm sad I'm not going to New York.
I'm not going either, as you just heard, but Gary will carry it for us. And before, just to let everybody know, we've got Chris Svensson from Ford Design. In fact, he's the director of design for Ford Americas, and we'll have him in the second half of the show. But right now, we got to get caught up on all this GM stuff.
Yeah, you've been writing about it this week, and S10 Baja, the very first question here in the chat room someone put up, will GM make it through this crisis, or are they doomed? Doomed.
They're not doomed, but boy, this thing's going to hurt yet. And we just got word today, you know, at first they came out and said, well, we're going to take a $300 million charge in the first quarter on our financial statement because of this recall. Then they upped that to $750 million, and today they just bumped that up to $1.3 billion. So this thing's getting expensive real fast.
And they added the ignition locks to the ignition switches. Did you see that?
No, what's that?
That happened like 20 minutes ago, earlier today. Yeah, they added up more recalled cars, the ones that already come back, I think, right? Aren't they going to have to go back in, too?
Yeah, I think that's what it sounded like. Yeah. But so apparently that you could literally take the key out while the car is still running.
Oh, wow. I remember that in cars from way back.
Well, yeah,
I didn't know that these could do it.
But I don't think they were supposed to be able to do it. I think maybe that's the issue. But, I mean, it you know, as more and more of these things come out, you know, you begin to wonder what the consequences will be for the company going forward. What is the sense of somebody who's going to go into the dealership going to be? Will he or she really feel comfortable about buying a product from that company?
Well, I think it makes that statement by Mary Barra about it's perfectly safe to drive the car, just take all the keys off the key ring and all of that. It makes that seem more and more ludicrous by the day.
Well, you know, we talked about this several weeks ago, and somebody, I don't know if it was in the chat room or during the rapid fire thing, said, should Mary drive a Cobalt to the hearings? And I said at the time, oh, of course not. She should drive a new car, like a new CTS or something like that. Now, whoever that was, whoever came up with that question, you were brilliant. That's exactly what she should have done. She should have driven to the hearings in a Cobalt with the defective switch, with only the ignition key. So when they start berating her about whether these cars are safe or not, she could have said, Senator, I drove one of those cars here today.
And she had the executive staff sitting in the back seat. You know what I mean? we're gonna up the ante here and make sure that that is going to work out fine for all that are considered.
In fact, I think that GM should make a video of Barra at the proving grounds, going over the Belgian blocks and all the different torture tests that they put a car through, and prove, hey, look, and maybe put Mark Royce and a bunch of other executives in the back seat and say, look, here we are driving this
car. Their eyes are like this.
But, you, of course, you would have the GM engineers looking at that car ahead of time and making sure it's inspected. So, I mean, like, how much of it would really be?
Well, look, right now the public doesn't believe anything that GM is saying. Nothing. And now they've got a lawsuit trying to force them to immediately park all these cars or tell the customers to immediately park it. So they've got to do something that convinces the public, look, it's safe. Just don't put anything else on the ignition key and you're good to go.
Which is, I mean, let's face it. I mean, that's somewhat absurd. I mean, the notion that people should not have things on their keychains, right? I mean, under the circumstances, yes, if you have stuff on there, take it off right now. Don't do it. But, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we all know that we have house keys on there and things from CVS and, you know, all kinds of other keys for offices and whatnot. I mean, that's just a natural thing. And to say, okay, so I've just, you know, some years ago I spent $12,000 on a car, but I can't have anything on the keychain if I have that car. I mean, come on.
It's a bad design from the get-go. Everybody knows that now.
This is why I own Saabs. Because they have the keyhole right in the center, and there's no, like, gravity pulling on the key cylinder, the lock cylinder. And they always said that was a safer design because, you know, you wouldn't have your knee go into your wad of keys in an accident. But maybe it helps for that, too.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm glad you're on the show here, Chris, so that we now know why we should go out and buy socks.
if there really weren't very many reasons.
Yeah, if you can find one. But see, the thing I wonder about is that, Mary Barra made a statement, and I think it was also today, about how the real emphasis there is on safety and quality at General Motors. And, you know, it almost seems to me that if you get quality right, safety comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, is there going to be a tendency for people to really pull back in some ways in terms of product development because they're going to say, I wonder if this is really safe or not. You know what I mean? Just like take it to the extreme.
Here's the whole thing. You know, GM has recalled hundreds of cars. I looked it up on the NHTSA website from 2000 to 2008. They had hundreds of recalls. So this is an aberration, this one thing. It was a design defect. It got swept under the rug deliberately, I believe now. We'll see if the facts bear that out, but I believe it was. So here everyone's piling on GM that they're too cost conscious and they didn't have a proper safety system. Everything worked fine except for this one ignition switch on these one string of models. You know, everything else was good to go, or it did get recalled. So I think the company's got to be very careful in beating itself up. I mean, it's got to show the public and, you know, the legal system that it's doing things, but... Like I said, they did plenty of other recalls that did not get swept under the rug.
But you know, I do think it's, you know, it is worrisome from a cultural perspective. And I've been talking to, you know, friends and neighbors and other people in the industry. And I actually have a friend of mine who used to be an engineer at General Motors. And he pointed to a completely different problem with the tailgates in Trailblazers. And they were apparently opening and they couldn't figure out why. So they built a shaker unit. And the tailgate wouldn't open, and they said, there's no problem here. But when they did the tests, they took all of the panels off on the inside. And what they found out was later, when they put the panels back on, the panels inside flexed so much that it was disrupting the mechanism, and the door would pop open. There's never been a fix for it. And he claims that, and I believe this gentleman, that he was asked not to... not to report that and to sign off that everything is okay. We built the shaker unit and all that. And he said, I'm not willing to do that. Never know.
Well, there was some good news for General Motors this week. J.D. Power came out with his U.S. Customer Service Index study, and Cadillac came in first in the luxury segment, and Buick came in first in the non-luxury segment. So all the people who are bringing their Cadillacs and Buicks back to the dealers are very happy with what's happening there.
Or at least the ones filling out the J.D. Power survey.
That's true.
Yeah.
Chevy came in fifth in the, so that's not too bad.
Well, you know, getting back to this ignition switch defect, too, they just suspended two engineers with pay. They haven't fired them. So They're starting to take some action. They're starting to hone in on who was involved with this problem and who may or may not have swept it under the rug. I think the story is going to go on for months.
And in the meantime, you see other automakers using this General Motors air cover to slide out their own recalls.
Yeah.
Right?
And $6.5 million from Toyota.
Yeah, and it's just because it's they've got the cover to do things now. And I think that's NHTSA probably has a lot of pressure on them to clear their books of everything that was on the cusp.
Yeah, how much of this is an acute awareness of the fact that people are going to be more relentless in their focus on whether there are problems with cars. And therefore, if you have some issue that maybe 4 or 5 years ago would be, we'll just take care of it on a need-be basis. We'll put out a service bulletin about it, and if we have a sufficient number of people come in, and now people are saying, wait a minute, this isn't the case anymore. And so suddenly it's almost like you can go to websites and get all kinds of information about, television sets or whatnot and see what real people think about this. Well, now this information is being accumulated by car owners, mm-hmm. and they're beginning to chime in about problems. And so if you have these problems, at this point, and then in light of the, what was it, $1.2 billion that Toyota had to pay?
Yeah, the fine.
The fine. And, now we're getting some real money. So, yeah. People are going to be very, very gun-shy about trying to turn a blind eye to
suspect all of those penalties are going to go up, too. We've got General Motors this week has a $7,000 a day penalty for not answering all of the questions. That's like a clerical error for them. That's not, it's not anything substantive.
Yeah, but it still is bad from a PR standpoint.
Absolutely, absolutely. But I think the government's going to want more power. And they're going to want a bigger sword to wave around.
Yeah, well, NHTSA, they're at fault in all this, too.
Of course.
They had
Absolutely.
All kinds of data, and they didn't move on it. So, to start slapping GM with a $7,000 a day fine, to me, is kind of like, we're really going to come
Absolutely.
After you. Well, try to take the heat off themselves.
There's plenty of blame to go around on both sides, and I think you'll see, job losses on both sides eventually, and it's going to be interesting.
This is an interesting question from JM1NB. If the solution is removing keys from a keychain, then why isn't General Motors not sending out detachable key rings to owners? Now, you're talking about PR. Now, wouldn't that be a brilliant PR maneuver?
Detachable key ring.
They just,
Click it
that's
right
a very
off.
That's a very smart little thing, sure.
Just,
it's a little gesture.
What's it going to cost them? Less than $7,000 a day. There's a lot of cars, but still, why not? Wouldn't that be something that would elevate mm-hmm. their presence in the market, and people would see that they're really doing something? And if you didn't get an appointment for your car to get serviced, or the parts weren't at the dealership yet, why not have that? That's a fantastic idea.
It is. But enough of this stupid ignition switch recall. I want to talk about this augmented reality head-up display that Land Rover just showed. I don't know if you guys have seen that or not. I'm blown away by this concept.
It's amazing how much cameras are taking over in cars and how much more capability they're offering us. So this is a really brilliant system, to me, at least at first blush. And what it is, it's cameras mounted in the front of the vehicle, so that you can see right in the immediate vicinity when you're going up, and it
the vicinity of where
of the
wheels
vehicle.
Are the
right.
front wheels
correct.
Are
correct, and then it projects the image on the screen on a heads up display on the windshield, so it looks like, as you can see on the screen, you can see the road
for off road vehicles,
sure,
not for driving down 696.
Sure, but what's another interesting thing is I just read that with big rigs, with 18 wheelers. Over half of the accidents that they have with pedestrians when they're coming from a stop, where they hit pedestrians, they don't even know they're there. So they have to have people.
They're below the hood line.
Right. So they have people flagging them down, saying, you've got a person stuck on your front end or under your car. This is something that could really.
You can see them.
Right. It would mitigate that, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I'm knocked out by this. Head-up displays have been around for quite a while. They're starting to spread into lower-priced cars right now. GM is especially aggressive in starting to use them. And, this thing makes it look as if you can see right through the hood, right where your wheels are. I think it could go beyond just being good for off-roading. And, mm-hmm. Think about being on a track. you know, where you can put the wheel right on the apex, right on.
Although I hope you're not looking right there. You should be looking down.
Well, yeah, maybe you should.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, this is just the beginning. This whole concept of augmented reality is really going to hit in the next decade where, you know, as I keep saying, imagine Google Earth projected onto your windshield. So now your navigation system via Google Earth is projected on there, and instead of trying to watch the screen and figure out where you're supposed to go, the road that you're supposed to be on will be illuminated. You know, it can be yellow or red or whatever color you want, and you just follow that road as you drive. And there's so many other things that can be brought using augmented reality, just like fighter pilots have today in fighter jets.
Sure.
But to automotive and to civilian use.
I'm just fearful when that advertisers figure out how to, you know, use that. And so you've got a sign over here saying Big Macs or $2 or whatever it is as you drive by and they're serving you ads. That would be...
Well, it'll be okay from a driving standpoint once we get autonomous cars, but it'll be bad from a driving standpoint because who wants ads popping up on the windows of the car?
Right.
Well, see, this will subsidize the Google Earth thing that he's talking about. it'll be AdWords on the side. So as you're driving by these places, it'll pop up these things, and it'll be a little cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
And it'll probably get to the point where, you know, your whole connected network at home knows that you're low on milk, and it'll remind you as you drive by, you need a gallon from this place. And, I mean, it'll just be that way.
I think we're going to start seeing a lot more augmented reality. I've seen... presentations that use augmented reality to show you several cars in front of you what's going on. So if you're behind a big truck or SUV and you can't see down the road, the augmented reality through your head-up display will let you know if somebody's slamming on the brakes or swerving or if there's a big pothole or whatever it happens to be.
It'll be so very busy here in Michigan if that's the case.
Right.
Well, the other thing you got to wonder about, though, is to the, you know, the extent that people are going to be able to absorb this information while still trying to pilot a car. I mean, you know, a number of people, and I'm sure we all experienced it driving here this evening. I mean, you look at these people and they're barely capable of driving the car as it is. Now, just imagine if they had all kinds of other inputs in addition to their cell phone calls and what they're listening to on the radio and you know, any number of other distractions, and suddenly they're able to see what's going on three cars ahead. Oh.
What I love is that I think a lot of these vehicles come with these amazing technologies and then people don't actually use them, right? I mean, it's like the flashing 12 o'clock on the VCR that nobody knows how to set. Look at how many people are driving late model vehicles and they've got their you know, cell phone up to their ear and they're in their car alone. And you know that that car comes standard with Bluetooth. You know it.
Right. Exactly right. And I see that. I see that all
every
the time.
Day.
Yeah, absolutely right, Chris. Mm. Unbelievable. So one other topic, Gary, that you had suggested we get to is hybrids versus diesels.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was that interesting announcement that the aforementioned General Motors made this week about investing $449 million in their Hamtramck plant where they're making the Volt. And also a good chunk of change is going to their Brownstown plant where they assemble the battery modules for, they call it an electric vehicle, but we know it's a hybrid. And, you know, you were making the point that the diesel sales are really taking off in the United States. And it's my contention that hybrid sales are going to be the ones that are going to be growing. So we saw today that BMW is introducing in New York the new hybrid system that they're going to be putting on the X5. Bentley announced that they're going to have a plug-in hybrid vehicle, and they're going to be showing that in their SUV. This will be and so it just strikes me that as we look at the amount of development that is going on by a wide variety of auto manufacturers, and they're investing their money in hybrid systems, they're not investing their money to the same extent in diesel technology.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, while we may be seeing this blip with diesel sales, I think that in the long run, the hybrid sales are going to grow inexorably.
They will, only because to meet fuel economy standards, automakers are going to electrify their cars so much more. And, you know, now we've got to also define what's a hybrid. Do you guys count the the mild hybrid that you get in the Chevy Malibu, for example. Is that really a hybrid? I don't know. You can't drive in pure electric power with it, and it really doesn't do a whole lot of real world for the fuel economy.
Right.
But what I find so interesting is for the last 5 months in a row, hybrid sales in the U.S. market have declined. Mm-hmm. Declined. And that's pure market demand at a point where the market is growing very strongly in the last 5 months. Diesel sales have gone down.
And, no, diesel sales have gone
down. Excuse me, hybrid sales, yeah, have right. gone down. And I just find that an interesting statistic to point
it,
out.
It is. And I was actually at Auburn Hills this morning for a Jeep background event for their Easter Safari, where they show off a bunch of customized models, including one Grand Cherokee EcoDiesel. And so I took the opportunity to ask about how that's doing, because it went on the market in the fourth quarter last year. And it's about 15% of sales. And they're very pleased with it so far. They said the days to turn are super quick, much more so than almost any other model.
That's a pricey diesel.
It's a really pricey diesel. And if you look at it, it's priced shoulder to shoulder with the Germans. And in fact, they said that they're getting converts out of X5s and Q7s and such. I mean, what Mike Manley said was that it's one of those things that, you know, they want a vehicle that actually drives in snow. And they're finding that they can get that. And I know that the early sales for the EcoDiesel Ram 1500, you know, the dealer orders were extraordinary. And I was actually just talking to Nick Kappa on the phone from Ram just before we came out here. And he said that they're at 10 to 15%, and they're real pleased with it.
Sure. Yeah. But, I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, those sorts of vehicles are the types of vehicles that really, really require things like that.
But I bet you if we could get General Motors to break out their data on the Cruise diesel, it's probably nothing.
It's not very big, but it still is not available coast to coast. Hmm. They're just starting to spread it out right now. But you're right. I don't have the data right in front of me, but they're not big numbers. Hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break here? I'm dying to get our guest, Chris Svensson from Ford Design, on the show. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability. Impressive mileage. Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run. Again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
AutoLine offers you one of the most effective ways to get your marketing message in front of the decision makers in the global automotive industry. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Chris Svensson, welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Great to be here.
So you are the director for design for Ford Americas, and you just got that full assignment, just a couple of months ago?
In January, yeah. So previously I was exterior design director for Ford North America. So now I'm responsible for interior, exterior, for North America and South America.
And you've spent most of your career with Ford, is that right?
All of my career with Ford. I've been with Ford for 22 years.
And in a variety of different places around the world.
Yeah, I started in Germany, in Cologne, in 92. Spent quite a long time in Germany. Then I came to the U.S. on assignment in 96 and 97. And then I went to the UK. So even though I'm originally from the UK, I was a Ford of Germany employee. Went back to the UK for about 10 years. Then I've been in Asia Pacific for 3 years. So I was in Australia, in Melbourne, liaising with our leadership team in China. And then I've been here a year and a half. So, yeah, well-traveled.
So what do you make of having the Americas as opposed to Asia or Europe? What kind of things are you thinking about as you look at designing cars for this part of the world?
Well, I think what I bring to the job is that I've got a lot of global experience. And I think what we're finding now is that we're exporting from North America to other parts of the world as well. Where we, in the regions that I've worked, it's generally like Asia Pacific, for example, it was importing mostly. We did have a regional industry in Australia with Falcon and Territory. But we had most of the cars were imported. So I have a lot of experience, and we're starting to develop specific products for China marketplace, which I was involved in when I was in Asia Pacific. So I have a lot of global experience, and that's what I bring to the job here. So understanding the global markets and understanding how the North America products can really fit into a global perspective.
Is there becoming a acceptance of one design for around the world? I mean,
the way we work is we're very customer focused. So yes, we have an understanding of our platforms and some products that we believe are globally acceptable. But we do tailor those products regionally as well. So for example, the Fusion you get here isn't quite the same as the Mondeo that you get in Europe and other areas. So it's tailored specifically to the customers that we're selling it to.
But if we had them side by side here in the studio, would somebody who isn't you be able to look at that and say they're tailored in a different way?
They might look like different series. They might have different finishes. They might have different material finishes on the interior. They might have some might have certain slightly different headlights to the other. The fundamental shapes would be the same, mm-hmm. but there would be detail executions that would be different from region to region. Mm-hmm. And there would be technologies, for example, headlights. There would be technology differences between those two products. Mm-hmm. So, yes, as a designer, I spot them. Maybe as a customer, might not be so obvious, mm-hmm. yes.
Because I wonder, I mean, we look at the Focus is a big hit around the world. Yeah. I mean, and I dare say that if we were to go back 20 years, that would never have happened. And I just wonder whether it's because there's a greater homogenization of.
I think there is. Living in Asia Pacific for 3 years previous to coming here, that region really progressed. In that 3 years I was there, it really accelerated in terms of their knowledge of the automotive industry, and it was very. I felt when I got there, it was a very fresh, naive marketplace, but they caught up at such speed. The technologies like the internet and things that they have so much access now that it was very quick for them to catch up. So I think we are finding there is a level of homogeneousness that's going on within the customer base, because mm-hmm. everybody seems to have access to technology and know what's available around the globe.
So they don't want second best, they want first best. They don't want to take.
Yeah, and I think that's the case. I think, maybe if you go back 10 years, you've probably felt that you could get away with, a lesser product. I don't think that's the case anymore, mm-hmm. not at all.
Go ahead, John. How do you divide design up in Ford? It seems to me that everything from Fiesta to Mondeo or Fusion is done in Europe. Taurus?
No, that's not the case.
Okay.
We design the products where the engineering resource is, because the engineering part of the business is the biggest part of the PD development process. Design is a smaller part of it. And where the engineering capability is, the flexibility for engineering is, that's probably where we're going to design the product. Or where the key marketplace is, that's where we'll design the product. And it changes. It doesn't necessarily mean, because we've always done Fiesta and Focus in Europe, that we're going to continue to do that. It depends on where the lead market is and the volume is, and that we can move that around. We have engineer PD facilities, design facilities all around the world. We also have a process where within design, the design team itself, it works together. So we, in certain products that will be global products like Fiesta and Focus, we have what we call design competitions, where all of the design studios participate in the process of developing the car. And it might be that it's just a sketch review, or it might be that each region does a model. And you'll find that they have slightly different flavors because of the regional requirements. So we bring them back to have a bigger review. So we get a lot of input into the final execution of a product. based on our studios globally.
So Ford Americas, what do you guys have?
What do we have? Oh, I mean, we have Mustang, we have F-150. You know, we have at the moment we've got, you know, those are the key products that I believe, you know, we won't ever, you know, lose. They're the heartland of what we do here. But we're working on many other products, some global as well.
I thought you guys would be done. You did the Mustang, did F-150. You guys are probably sitting around.
Never stop.
You know. Kicking back in your chair,
smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, you know, it's like
that lasts about 10 minutes. Yeah,
but you know, talk a little bit about this whole process. That you said that, you know, where the engineering teams are is where the designers need to be. So, I mean, is there a real close working relationship that you have? And I mean, and
there is,
because isn't it you just like design and say, okay, guys, just.
No,
it's an iterative
process. Engineering is as important, you know, because in the good old days when it was styling and engineering and the two never really came together, it's a different world now. You know, we work together to ensure that we deliver the product because there is so much technology and so much reliance on the functionality of our product that we have to work together as a synergy. Because otherwise, you know, I don't want to be a person that's just styling the car. I want my product to actually be a functional product mm-hmm. that customers want to use and are capable of delivering, you know, their needs. And that's not just making a pretty picture. That's making a product that is desirable, but is also, you know, is clever and is functional.
So other than safety and government regulation, what's driving design right now? I mean, can you talk about socioeconomic changes in the culture influencing design?
I mean, you talked about a little bit in the first half when you talked about technologies and you talked about the automation of the driving environment. You know, those technologies are really impacting next generation products. You talked about hybrids and different systems to drive the vehicle forward. You know, those are throwing up different architectural differences. So for example, when with a current engine in the front of a car, you know, it dictates a certain package. The electrification of the car is driving a different type of package. You know, you can have batteries in the floor and it's flat, and you don't have to have a high nose because there isn't a big engine in the front. So these technologies are driving different architectures, different silhouettes to how the future products could look. I think the difficulty is finding that balance between, you know, people have a perception about what a car is and the way it looks and architecturally how it delivers on safety and how it delivers. You know, they want a big crush zone at the front. They want, you know, the feeling that it's a secure environment. It has glass that's, you know, this deep rather than it's going all the way down to here. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certain things that people expect from the product that delivers certain stylistic elements. So,
do you think, I mean, that's got to change over time, right? So if you end up with cars where everything is by wire and where everything is in that sandwich down there and you've got cars that don't crash, I would think that over time, over the generations, you know, of new motorists being introduced into the pool, that people won't be as worried about having glass go down because they're not going to crash and they're not going to have that
possibly.
Fear.
Possibly, and I think those are the questions we're asking ourselves right now. What is this technology going to bring to the automotive industry? But also we talk a lot to the customers. We want to know how people use the products, what they want from the products, what desires do they have. And that's key to us as well, is getting customer feedback and getting insights into the next generation of users. So we talk to people that maybe don't have a car right now. You know, they're not old enough to have a car, but they have certain key things that they're really into. You know, for example, lifestyle and sports and adventure. You know, what do these people? What are they gonna? You know, the people that maybe. Skateboarders or I don't know who, but they're not driving cars right now, but they're going to want cars in the future. What kind of cars are they going to want that builds on their lifestyle and is a is a tool to enable them to continue to enjoy their lifestyle. So those are the kind of things. I think customer is critical.
But is there a notion of what a car is that all of these people share?
I think it's changing. I really do.
Because, you know, it's probably not a good analogy, but, you know, I think of what a young person who doesn't drive a car now, let's say, what that person perceives to be a phone versus what I perceive to be a phone, which is probably different than what Chris perceives to be a phone and what that John perceives
and
to be a phone.
That's the balance. You know, we sell the Focus to you know, first-time buyers. We sell it to people that, you know, retired. It has to bridge that gap,
right,
of different personalities and different profiles of customer. We have to make a product that it's a very difficult process, mm-hmm. Especially when you start to talk to customers and the needs and wants of these people. So as a designer, that's the challenge. That's the challenge for us, is to create products that are desired by the guy that's retired or the young kid that's going to be his first car and, you know, his first steps into driving on the road. So that's my challenge.
Is there a possibility that because of engineering technology, because of production technology, because of 3D printing, because of something else, that we could get to the point whereby you would design a car for the retired person, another person would design a car for the skateboarder, someone else would design a car for another type person, and that would be a viable approach?
An individual car?
Well, maybe
specifically tailored
to categories, but not, I mean, because right now you have to appeal to, you know, this huge bandwidth, mm-hmm. right? And what I'm saying is that, okay, we could take slices of that, right? And you'd have a greater number of niches. Now, you know, now niche cars tend to be expensive, right? I mean, if you want to get something special, you're going to pay a lot of money for it. But, I mean, do you see the possibility that there might be
The way we do business is we have platforms, a specific platform that is a certain dimension. And then it's looking at the top hats that we put on that platform and understanding the top hats that we want to do. Portfolio vehicles. What will be that portfolio vehicles? And it doesn't necessarily mean that just because we've done it previously is going to be we're going to do it again and again and again. We still look at the marketplace and say, what is the correct portfolio vehicles to make sure that we hit the volumes that we believe we will. And some of them might be small volumes, but we feel that they're credible, and we need to ensure that we hit those because they build the brand. And some volumes might be huge, like the Focus, for example. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, it's a balance between this top hats. How many top hats you do to make we have to make money,
sure.
to ensure that we're going to make money. But understanding there are some ones that maybe aren't massive volumes, but they build the brand, and they bring customers into your brand that perhaps wouldn't necessarily look at you mm-hmm. with the other portfolio of vehicles that you had. So it's a very fine balance. Now, there are cleverer people than me that work on this, but you know, at the end of the day, we are involved in that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, to take that ball and run with it, I mean, if you've got cars that don't crash, then they probably don't need the crumple zones, and so you probably don't need to invest as much in the design process and crashing them and all of that. So it seems like you could end up with a scenario where you can do more of these niche cars, right? That it's more cost effective. And I've been wondering about this as it applies to coach builders, because coach builders have had a really rough run of it for the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, we lost Carmen, and I think Bertone they're on their last legs right now. They've got to have their financing by the end of the month or they're done. But if you've got a situation where there are fewer legal parameters that you have to meet, you know, in terms of crash and all that, it seems like...
But you're talking about a scenario where every single car on the road will never crash into each other. Mm. You know, we don't have a scenario where every single car on the road is a new car. We were always going to have a scenario where there's cars on the road that, you know, are 20, 30, 10 years old. So you're always going to find a situation that there will be something that crashes into you. So I don't think we'll ever get to a situation where we say, well, every new car that we sell is autonomous and we'll never crash into each other. What about the guy that's driving around in the 65 Mustang, you know? He might crash into you.
We'll get there someday. I think what Chris is talking about will happen, but it ain't going to happen in our career lifetime.
No, I'm not looking for that. But down the road, I think, you know, it's a possibility.
It could be. It could be.
Chris, as design director for Americas, does Lincoln report to you?
No, it doesn't.
Okay, there was just a change there. Max Wolf had been head of Lincoln Design. There's a new guy, David Woodhouse, I think is his name. Yes. What's the change? What's the story behind the change?
I'd rather concentrate on Ford.
Okay, well, look,
and that's because I know the story, but I would rather it came from the people who.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Not a problem. You mentioned Mustang, 65 Mustang. I understand you just had one restored, or a 64.
Well, it's a 65, but it was built in 64, late 64. It's a 2+2 fastback. It's all original, so it's never been modified or anything. But
But completely restored.
Completely restored. So the shell was taken back to bare metal, and it was. Every single bit was rebuilt on it. It's taken a year. I was actually thinking it was
going to... Here, we got a picture of it up on the screen.
Yeah, that's it. I was actually going to take longer to restore it, but I accelerated the end process because it's the anniversary of
50th anniversary.
50th anniversary, and I really wanted to get the car finished for the 50th anniversary. So.
And you told me you're driving it to the New York Auto Show.
Yes, I've never driven it. So when I bought it, it was undrivable. It went straight to restoration.
Look at that interior.
It's been in restoration a year. The first time I'll drive it is Monday morning when I'm driving to New York for the 50th anniversary, 600 miles. So
you better have your fingers crossed. You better, A, hope it starts, and B, gets all the way to New York.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. I mean, the guys that restored it did a beautiful, beautiful job. It's a gorgeous car.
I'm curious. Here's a Brit spent virtually most of your career outside of North America. What attracted you to getting a 65 Mustang?
Oh, it's iconic. It's the iconic American car. It's the epitome of what America stood for. It's, you know, it's freedom. It's expressive. It's dynamic. It's powerful. And I just wanted something that I could really get involved in the American culture. And for me, as soon as I landed, I started looking. I started looking for a Mustang. It's a beautiful, beautiful car. I absolutely adore it.
So when you're growing up, you were obviously interested in cars, and you know, you studied design to design cars. And did you look at the Mustang then, when you were on the other side of the pond, and say,
I grew up in England. Mustang, to some extent, you didn't really see that many Mustangs in the UK. I was passionate about Ford, though. My parents had Ford, so I was a very passionate Ford person. I had a Ford Cortina. I had a Lotus Cortina. Mark II was one of my first cars.
Awesome car. Yeah.
I was very, very passionate. My friends all had Mark I Escorts, twin cams. So really, really passionate about Ford. And I only ever wanted to work for Ford. I was passionate about cars from day one. A good artist as well. And what I've done is found a career that I can meld the two. The blood, I've got petrol running through my veins, but I'm also an artist at heart. And this career that I have had really was something that allowed me to pull my two passions, art and the automobile, together as a career.
In addition to the Mustang, you have any other classics?
I have a few, yes.
Like what? Can you tell us?
I have a 57 356, once again has just been.
That's not a Ford, by the way.
Yeah, it's an iconic.
It's an F.
It's an iconic Porsche. I just love the purity and the simplicity of that car. There's something intrinsically warm about that car when you see it as well. It's, it, it, you know, it it It's very desirable. The forms, the voluptuousness of it, I just adore
it. Makes you want to get in it and drive it.
Yeah. That's another car I've never driven. So I bought that car when I was in Australia, and it's taken 3 years to restore. It's just about to be put on a boat and sent here to America. So that's another car I'm looking forward to driving.
It's gonna be like Christmas.
I've sat in the car and turned the steering wheel a few times as we pushed it around around my backyard, but I've never driven it. So
that's cool. That's so great.
What else?
Oh God! Is my wife watching this?
Yeah, you don't want your wife to know. That's great.
No.
Honey, I've got another car.
Yes, that's great.
Shipping in tomorrow.
Yeah, I've got an old bike that needs restoring. I've got an old couple of cars here and there, but the Mustang and the Porsche are probably the two that I feel really passionate about. I can't wait to Monday morning to drive that Mustang. I'm really itching. I had it at work, so the company that's restoring it, we brought it to work on Wednesday, because we had a little design event in the studio, in design studio, to celebrate the 50th anniversary. And it's a little bit ahead of time, but we wanted to pull everybody together. And I brought the car in for that. Couldn't drive it. It's still not finished at that point on Wednesday.
Wow.
But that's what those photographs were from. It was getting delivered to the design studio. And I sat in it and turned the steering wheel and I thought, oh, my God, you know, I did actually turn it on and listen to the engine. God, it sounds beautiful.
So it's got to be, what, a 289?
It's a 289A code. It's all original. I found it in Reno and it was in fairly good shape. It sat in someone's garden for 30 years. Mm-hmm. So, as I said, I started searching as soon as I touched down off the plane. So,
and I mentioned the interior. Ben's got that shot up right now. It's
a manual, four-speed.
Four-speed?
Yeah.
Whoa, that was bleeding edge in the day.
Yeah,
four-speed.
This is how it came from the... So it's all...
Four on the floor.
It's factory. So it has the rally pack on the column as well. That was factory. I bought it from the person that bought it brand new off the lot.
You're only the second owner.
Wow. Yes. Yes.
In 50 years. That's pretty impressive.
He really wanted to restore it, but he just didn't have the time or the financial way to be able to deliver it to this level.
Well, what's amazing is, looking at the carpeting and the door trim panels and all that, the carpeting's got to have been replaced.
Most of it.
But it looks exactly like the carpeting when the car was new.
Yeah, Most of it on the interior had to be replaced, to be honest. But the quality of the parts available today is just phenomenal here. It's, you know, you can get every single little nut and bolt for this car. It costs you a fortune, but it's there.
You could probably build an entire one from the aftermarket.
I'm sure you could, yeah.
Yeah. Do you find your young designers as passionate about cars as you were when you were their age?
Yes, I do. I think they are. Without doubt. You know, it's interesting. We've got a young designer, one of the young guys that's just joined us. And, his first car just joined Ford Motor Company. You know, his first purchase, he went out and bought a second-hand Porsche Boxster. You know, that's the kind of people we want working for us, guys that have got passion about cars, that just want to design cars and just want to be in the culture of cars. Mm-hmm. I think it's. I think we do find those people within.
There's hope for the world yet.
So, given where you grew up and the type of vehicles that you were around, you said you were a Ford family, but you talked mostly about sporty cars, small cars, and small sedans.
My mom had minis. You know, yeah. We grew up with a. We had other cars other than Ford, so we had Jaguars and Minis and, you know, all sorts of eclectic cars.
Sure. So how is that to design trucks now for you?
Trucks. The thing is, I think a good designer can design anything. I think if you understand the customer, you understand it's where it needs to fit and what kind of product these people really desire. I think a good designer should be able to turn his hand to anything, be it a truck, be it a sports car, be it a van. I mean, one of my jobs and roles that I've had in the in my career is I was responsible for all our commercial vehicles in Europe. Mm. So I did the transit. I did all the transits. I was responsible. I was the chief
designer. Successful.
Yeah, so I was chief designer for all the current generation of transits that have just been launched. That was one of my projects that I worked on before I moved to Asia Pacific. So I think as a good designer, you should be able to turn your hand to anything. You should be capable of designing a truck, designing a commercial vehicle, designing a sports car. You intrinsically know what appeals to a customer. And I think that's the link that you need to have. Being able to visualize it as an artist, I think that's something that is really good. And being able to be passionate about communicating it to your design management is important as well. So for young designers, being able to draw is key, but being able to talk about your ideas and your thoughts is important too.
Hey, look, this is probably a good transition time to get to some of the questions coming in from our audience. So, Ben, let's get to rapid fire. Okay, we've got a number of questions that have come in from the audience here. Right Knight wants to know, you guys are coming out with an aluminum-intensive F-150. He wants to know, is styling aluminum panels trickier than steel panels?
No. Nope. Rapid answer, no.
Harder to engineer, perhaps.
Perhaps, but it didn't impact in any way how we executed.
You can get the right
styling.
Creases, yeah. Radiuses, and yeah. all
you
those
You can actually get better.
Really?
Yes.
So this is not an audience question, it's mine. How about as you move to things like carbon fiber, and I'm not asking you to comment on future product, I'm just saying, would that compromise things that you could do or not?
No.
Very interesting.
So your designers have to understand things like how aluminum folds and how steel bends and how carbon fiber
not
lays up?
Not necessarily, no. I think at the end of the day, we design a car and we work with the engineering team to envisage that as a total feasible product at the end of the day. And the material finishes aren't necessarily impacting the way we do business. They're actually helping us to realize some of the forms that we do. Some of the forms that we create today probably, you know, especially in terms of plastics and the way that... some of those are formed is probably greater than ever was previously. But, you know, the metals and the plastics for fenders and things like that are not making it more difficult for us now.
Cool. Good to hear. Cozy 200 says, hello, Chris. My question is, if Ford had 50 years to get a 50th anniversary Mustang ready, why will we not see them at dealers on 4/17/14?
We didn't have 50 years. So we've had 50 years of continuous production of Mustang, which is, you know, there's only two companies that have had 50 years of continuous production of a single body style, which
Corvette's
is...
Corvette's the other?
No.
Suburban?
No. It's Porsche 911.
Oh.
Porsche 911 and Mustang are the only two products that have had 50 years of continuous production.
Ah, oh, Corvette's been around.
No, 83.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay.
So no, we haven't been designing the car for 50 years, but we've been designing a car for 50 years progressively. So we. There's a certain time frames in which you can design a car. So, you know, you have a certain amount of time to be able to do it. You do it as fast as possible. It's not always, you know, we didn't sit back 4 or 5 years ago and go, oh, my God, it's the 50th anniversary. We need to make sure we get it out and then get it on the foot. It's just a factor of where we were at the time. So,
yeah.
But I think that's fantastic that we've had 50 years of continuous Mustang.
It's impressive.
Yeah.
And what's even more impressive to me now is Ford's finally taking the international market seriously with that
yes.
car, doing a right-hand
yes.
steer version. I think it's brilliant.
I there are passionate Mustang people all around the globe. The Mustang clubs, you'd be amazed how many Mustang clubs there are globally. And the passion is not just North America. It's everywhere, and I think that car will be very successful in the world market.
I do too. I think it's going to do a lot for the Ford brand overall.
Yeah.
JM1NB, who was in the chat room earlier,
has a question for you, too. How does the manufacturing plant affect design? I got to imagine when you set out to design something, there are manufacturing limitations. How do you guys, I know you work, you talked about working with engineering. How does manufacturing fit into that?
Well, yes, we have manufacturing is involved. They do come and they, you know, we talk about how we put these things together. You know, there are certain dimensional things that we have to accommodate as well. You know, the plants have certain line paths that certain widths and things like that. So it's an iterative process. We work together. It's not just design and engineering. It is manufacturing. It is marketing. They have a key role in it as well. You know, there are many, many factors. We all sit in a room and we talk about how we move things forward.
So designers ever walk around in plants?
Yes, we do.
Really?
Yes, we do. Yes. In fact, one of the things that a designer, when they join us, has to do is they have to spend, I think we're looking at a month now, has to spend a month in the plant.
Wow.
Working in the plant before.
What's the thinking behind doing that?
So they understand. So they understand how the cars are put together and how we do manufacture them. So when they sit down and they do these sketches, they have a realization that somebody has to bolt it together, or, you know, so it's critical.
It's great.
When was that implemented, that they have to spend a month there?
No, so it's a more recent, we've always had them go into the plant, but I think we've expanded it now to look at doing it for a month.
And what do they do there? Just walk around and look, or do they actually?
No, they're on the line screwing them together.
Fantastic. I think that's a great move. Mm. I think that's a terrific move. Charles Gallagher wants to know, when will Ford re-enter the body-on-frame town car segment? You can't talk about future product, I know.
No, I don't.
He says, the F-150 platform seems like a high-volume place to start. Can you ever imagine doing a passenger
town car? Off an F-150?
Well, let's just say a car. Forget a town car. Wouldn't it make sense to be able to build a passenger car off one of those truck platforms? I mean, the volume on the platform is so humongous.
I'm not sure you'd deliver the kind of road handling that you would expect from a modern saloon vehicle. I'm not sure, to be honest.
Some wacky vehicle that people could beat around in Baja or something, you know.
Like a Raptor.
Yeah.
This is maybe not so much for you, Chris, but for the other Chris and Gary. Have any of you seen the leaked pictures of the brand new Lexus NX CUV? I think this is that.
I have, yeah.
Super over-designed one, right?
That is exactly a great way of putting it. They've shown several concept versions of this new small Lexus, and it's taken them forever to come out with another crossover because the RX is their bread and butter. I mean, that and the ES are really the thing that hauls in all the profits for Lexus.
Always
and
happen.
It's amazing that they haven't come up with another crossover to this point. So this is probably the fullest realization of their new styling direction, which has that spindle grille and all of that. And it is seemingly rather overwrought, especially in the front end where the grille is just, yeah, there's the leaked shot.
Yeah.
it's got presence, I'll say that. I mean, you definitely won't mistake it for anything else, but there is an awful lot going on. It looks like it wants to eat your children or something. I don't know.
And it quite possibly may.
It might. I'm not a big fan of this styling language thus far that they're putting out, especially as they've been adapted to vehicles. So I had a Lexus LX, you know, the 570, the big, basically the Toyota Land Cruiser with frosting. And I thought that front end added to that just didn't really work. And it works even less on the GX to me. But I think they're starting to get it right. So the RC Coupe, I think that looks really good. I think it, you know, once they smooth it all out and they figure it out, there'll be something there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're seeing a lot of activity. The GS, the IS are doing so much better, and it's sort of interesting to watch how the ES is now beginning to fade away and that the more sporty Lexi are
sure
the ones that are coming to the fore.
Well, and they're also probably going to be putting a lot of marketing budget behind the newer vehicles. And mm-hmm. So,
Chris Svensson, I'm curious, what do you think of all this move to
A-class crossovers. We seem to be seeing a lot of that all around the world.
I think crossovers is a thriving marketplace. We have a really good CUV lineup with the Escape. We've just shown the concept for the new Edge. I think we really have a good portfolio of CUV and SUV products.
And Ford's got a great B-class one, the EcoSport.
Yeah.
Do you think that would work in the North American market?
I think it would, yeah. I think it's a bulldog of a little product that would really appeal.
I agree with you. I love the way the new one looks, and I think it would find a lot of appeal here.
Yeah. I think we've concentrated a lot on that marketplace because I think we do have going from all the way from a B car all the way up to a D segment CUV and SUV lineup that's very strong.
Dan the Man wants to know, will the new Ford Taurus follow the Fusion design language?
We'll have to wait and see.
You don't know?
I do know. I worked on it, so.
Hey, we're at the top of the tower hour here, but I got a question. What do you make of these, some people call them matte paint finishes, but I don't think they're truly matte. They're more of a satin finish. The Germans tend to call it frozen. You know, this no depth of gloss or almost none to speak of.
I'm a very... keen on alternative finishes and paints, and I think that brings a new. When you look at surfaces in high gloss, sometimes you lose the
detail.
You lose the essence of the surfacing. Especially when light gets distracted, and some of the matte surfaces actually highlight the surfaces and the sculpturing much better than gloss surfaces. So I'm keen on. I like to see form. We talked about the Porsche and how simplistic and voluptuous it is. I really like to see form, and some of these paint finishes really emphasize form rather than just it's a glossy paint finish. So
we've also heard a lot of talk over the years of plastic glazing. I know that's kind of an oxymoron. Polycarbonate windows, maybe not the windshield, but side glass, maybe backlight and all.
It does offer you a great flexibility in especially as you get around to the rear of the car and how you integrate the side glass, the rear glass, and the lights, especially if they're up high. It does give you a great deal of flexibility in design to be able to use different forms of in that area. So,
has Ford done that in any design anywhere in the world yet?
We have used that in different products in the past. But I think as we move forward, I think we're understanding these material finishes and how can we push the boundaries of the capability of the material. So I think it's a real positive.
And glass is so heavy, one would think that it's a great lightweighting benefit, too.
And I think you'll see more lightweighting as we move to... we talked earlier about technologies and things that will impact the future of the automotive industry. I think lightweighting is a key trend that you'll see more and more of, be it material finishes or be it minimizing componentry that you put in the vehicles to try and improve your weight. So I think you'll see more and more of that.
And some quick thoughts of yours on lighting. We're seeing so much being thrown into the headlamps these days. They're getting to be super expensive, but from a design standpoint, they're really interesting.
As a designer, I love it. It gives us the opportunity to really go to town. Technology has given us great opportunities that we never had before to be able to do things that are absolutely stunning. And I think the expectation of the customers out there is, they have iPhones and they have, their products in their house, like the Samsung tellies or whatever, that are beautifully executed. The stands on these TVs, they're just pieces of gorgeous sculpture in their own right. So their expectation is that a product that is so expensive has high quality detail in like their iPhone or their Samsung telly or whatever. So it gives us the opportunity to really go to town on doing some things like that. And overplaying the detail, because I think it's key to you know, customers' expectation of quality is about detail execution.
As you integrate these new materials, things like aluminum, or maybe it's not a new one, but carbon fiber and all of that, do you have a desire to make that visual to the customer?
I think it's very good to see the finishes that you're utilizing. I think it's you know, it does bring it, you say carbon fiber, it does bring its own warmth with the material finish. You know, why would you want to cover it up when it's such a beautiful material? So yeah, I think they are, you know, they're giving us benefits, because then we don't have to cover them. We don't have to, you know, you don't have to wrap it in cowhide. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to hide it. Aluminium, you know, you can expose it and use the rawness of the material finish. So I think these are positives.
Very good. With this, I think we should wrap it up. But Chris Svensson, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours.
It's been great. It's been great chatting to you guys.
Well, we always like talking about design. Oh, Gary's got something to read before we...
So as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be in New York for the auto show next week, and Chris will be there if his Mustang makes it. No, he'll make it.
It will make it.
Knock on wood.
So for those of you who would like to send in questions, we're going to need them by next Tuesday night. Send them to viewermail@autoline.tv, and this will be the full list of guests we're going to have on the show. Mark Fields, Ford COO, Dave Zukowski, President and CEO of Hyundai Motor America, Ken Parkinson, Executive Director of Chevy Global Design, Raj Nair, Group Vice President, Product Development at Ford, Pierre Loing, VP of Product Planning for Nissan North America, Michael Sprague, Executive Vice President, Sales and Marketing, Kia Motor America, Maury Callum, Vice President of Design at Ford.
You might know who
he's
that
my
is.
Boss.
And I understand he's driving a Mustang there as well.
Yes, we're going together.
Oh.
Yeah, so he has a 67 Mustang.
Uh-huh.
And we're both driving together.
Well, so you have parts if you know.
That's right, to swap out. Okay, there are more. Alana Tracy Barry, Product Manager of BMW North America with the X4, and Mike Manley, President and CEO of Jeep. And so that's viewermail@autoline.tv. And we'll need the questions by next Tuesday night. So there's a whole bunch of people, so have at it.
There you go.
It's a great lineup.
It is.
No Mary Barra.
Yeah. I think you'll be busy.
Yeah. Well, Chris Pockert, thanks for coming in.
Thanks. Always great.
Great having the Autoblog presence here with us on After Hours.
Thank you.
And Gary, the show's all yours, man.
Thanks,
I'm going to take a week off here. Well, not really. I can't make it to New York, but I'll be working. So I'll be watching, though.
Okay.
Sounds like a great show. In fact, maybe I'll try to think up some questions, too. So want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.